Welcome to Wealtheon. I'm Wealtheon founder Adam Taggart. Today we have something both unexpected and truly special for you. While a farmer isn't the kind of expert you'd expect to see interviewed on this channel, today's guest will convince you otherwise. Labeled as the most famous farmer in America, Joel Salatin has spent his career advocating for sustainable farming practices and pioneering models that show how food can be grown and raised in ways that are regenerative to our topsoils, are more humane to livestock, produce much healthier, tastier food, and contribute profitably to the local economy. Joel's one of my personal heroes and one of the most inspiring public speakers I've ever encountered. You'll see why I say that in just a moment. This is a replay of an interview I recorded with Joel right before launching Wealtheon last year. It's never been seen before on this channel, and I thought it high time to share it with you. Enjoy. Hi, folks. Extremely excited to welcome our next guest here on the seminar. He virtually needs no introduction, but for the few that may not know of him, I'll give a very quick one. This is Joel Salatin, oftentimes referred to as America's farmer. He describes himself as a Christian, libertarian, environmentalist, capitalist, lunatic, farmer. And Joel, just give me 1 second here to read this bio that you guys have on your site, because it's so great. Joel co-owns with his family Polyface Farms in Swope, Virginia, featured in the New York Times' bestseller, The Omnivore's Dilemma, an award-winning documentary, Food, Inc. Polyface Farms services more than 5,000 families, 50 restaurants, 10 retail outlets, a farmer's market with salad bar beef, pigerator pork, pastured poultry and forestry products. When Joel is not on the road or at seminars like this speaking, he's back at home on the farm, keeping the calluses on his hands and the dirt under his fingernails, mentoring young people, inspiring visitors, and promoting local regenerative food and farming systems. And that's exactly what we want to do here in this discussion. Joel, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you. It's an honor and a delight to be with you, Adam. Yes.
Well, thanks, Joel. Well, look, let's jump right in here. And very quick for folks, Joel is out in rural Virginia. We've done the best we can with the broadband connection here. There might be a little bit of jerks here and there. Just bear with us, because the quality of the insights you're going to get from Joel way outweigh any sort of glitches we might have on the broadband side of things. But Joel, getting back to food resilience, you know, I've known you for years. I know that this topic is near and dear to your heart. For folks that haven't been exposed to your thinking before, what are the biggest challenges to our current level of food resilience? What are the biggest things that we need to be doing differently?
You know, it's always easy. It's always easy to assume, well, you know, if those people would do what's right, you know, everything would be okay. It's always easy to try to, you know, put that shoe on somebody else's foot. And you know, people won't like to hear it, but the biggest challenge to our food resilience is simply the market, the consumers, all of us, to actually patronize non-fragile food. So I think there is a resilient food system and there is a fragile food system, and we can certainly dig down on what a resilient food system versus a fragile food system looks like. Or the difference between the two, but the arbiter of which side will be in the ascendancy. It's like the old guy that said, the child asked him, Grandpa, these two puppies, you know, which dog will do better? And Grandpa says, well, the dog that you feed. And so. So I think the arbiter of the fragile versus resilient system is ultimately the marketplace. The marketplace determines which of those dogs actually gets the ascendancy. And so, you very possibly want to talk about the differences between a fragile and a resilient food system. But let's make no mistake about you and I and everybody else that buys food. We are the ultimate arbiters of whether we move down a resilient path or a fragile path.
All right. And I do want to talk about what we as individuals can do to support those better models and feed the better solutions that are out there. But before we do, let's get everybody on the same page. When you talk about a fragile food system, can you just sort of pinpoint where you think the biggest points of vulnerability are in today's food systems here in the States?
Sure. Yeah. The biggest points of vulnerability are, number one, is centralization. You can call it centralization, amalgamation, empire building, whatever you want to call it, but a concentration. When you concentrate food production and processing in large spots, you concentrate the ability to have pathogens. You concentrate the labor pool, and that. As opposed to spreading the labor pool out, and you simply create waste streams that overrun their ecological, the ecological nest. It's one thing to have, five chickens in a backyard, for example. We'll go to the extreme. Five chickens in a backyard, that's one thing. It's quite another to have 500,000 in, concentrated in a couple of acres. One nests benignly and in a balanced way. The other is a toxic, a toxic stream. So concentration is certainly, I think, number one. Number two probably is segregation. So, a long time ago, the food system was primarily integrated. You had a couple chickens to eat your kitchen scraps, and you grew herbs, near kitchens. People, canned, and what made sauerkraut, and even had a, your home was also where you kept food. You had a larder. We don't even use the word larder anymore, but you had a larder where you kept your food, and so you actually integrated food into your house, into your curtilage, your yard, your garden, and into the greater community. The milk came from the dairy down the road, and the milk was left at your house. It was a heavily integrated system. Today we have a fundamentally segregated system. So this is part of the concentration. So as we have concentrated industrial scale production in tiny spaces, we have inherently reduced the level of connection and integration in all other spaces. So no longer the chickens are no longer next to the kitchen. The chickens are out in a concentrated animal feeding operation somewhere. And so the kitchen scraps go to landfill and the chickens get feed that's grown in a monoculture that's also separate from where the chickens are, that's fertilized with petroleum-based chemical fertilizer from the Middle East that's also separated. So we have instead of having this tight relationship, what you have is separation among the various, among the various things. That includes processing, for example, whether it's canning vegetables or abattoirs, slaughter, butchering animals and things. That used to be done in the community nearby, and now it's behind razor wire with no trespasser signs up and great big 4,000 person structures, and so you have concentration, you have segregation, and then probably the next one would be regulation. So regulation, what's happened as the food system industrialized and became segregated, the level of understanding about food decreased in the populace. Just a good story from us, I can remember 40 years ago, you couldn't go to the grocery store and buy, for example, a boneless, skinless chicken breast. You could only buy a chicken. And if you want a boneless, skinless breast, you know, you took it home and you took a knife and you whacked it out and you put the rest of the chicken and dumplings or casserole or something, you know, made stock and soup. So it was ubiquitous within the culture, for example, to know how to bone out a chicken, to cut up a chicken. Today, half of our customers don't even know that a chicken has bones. You know, they think we go out to this, you know, like boneless, skinless breast tree, you know, and pick boneless, skinless breasts off the tree, like apples and peaches. And so as people moved away from visceral culinary interaction, the level of ignorance increased. Well, what happens when ignorance increases? We become paranoid. We always fear what we don't know. And so food, instead of being something that was assumed faithfully good and helpful, became something to be feared. And so we moved into this fear mode, which then asked for government oversight, because we can't trust these big centralized, segregated, opaque outfits. And so we began down a path of regulatory oversight from the government that is always prejudicial against small scale operations. And so this becomes like a cancer that feeds on itself, it grows on itself. You have centralization, and then you have segregation, and then you have, because of all that, you have regulation, because people are fearful and they want, you know, the government's security, stamp of approval, because they don't understand food. They don't know where their chicken farmer, they don't know where their chicken came from. They don't know where their carrots came from. So we better have a government agent tell us that it's okay to eat this carrot or eat this chicken or eat this pound of ground beef. And that regulation has simply, it's been a feedback loop to put a lot of small outfits out of business and add to the concentration, add to the segregation. So it's a vicious cycle that all three of those elements feed on themselves. And we can see, for example, in this whole COVID pandemic thing, we can see, you know, when you look at the eating establishments that thrived, which ones thrived and which ones died? The ones that died were the small little diners. The ones that thrived were the great big mega chains that had drive-through windows. If you didn't have a drive-through window, you were out of business. And so that's just a simple little explanation of how regulations literally, routinely are prejudicial against small localized outfits, and they're concessionary toward large, well-connected outfits.
All right, extremely well said, Joel. And I wanna maybe toss one more in there, at least to ask you to react to, which is nutrition, which is sort of, as you went down this path of centralization to segregation to regulation, my assumption is that the actual nutritional value from the food, as each one of those three elements dials up, the nutritional value goes down, right? Because each of those things sort of rewards monoculture, the cheapest inputs that you can put in there, the least humane ways you can treat the animals because it yields the highest profit. I see you nodding here. So is that all true?
Yes, it certainly is true. And so what happened, we can't blame the government for this, but what happened as we withdrew from domestic culinary arts and asked for TV dinners and all this, what happened was convenience, maybe I should add convenience here on the fourth fourth leg of that stool would be our fixation on convenience and cheapness. And as we fixated on convenience and cheapness, we abdicated our role as participants in our own body's fuel, as participants in our own food system, and we gave that over to, you know, to processors, to red dye 29, to to all the manipulations in the processed food industry. And as a result of all of those things, our food quality, the nutritive capacity of our food has greatly decreased. And so the first one was concentration. Well, you know, concentration works if you're going to the philosophy under concentration is that food is fundamentally a mechanical thing, not a biological thing. And so in order to develop the industrial concentration capacity that we did, it required a worldview, a paradigm that viewed food as fundamentally mechanical rather than biological. And as soon as you view food as fundamentally mechanical, then it simply becomes parts and widgets that we can break apart, manipulate, and we can get red with a laboratory chemical composition of red, not, you know, actual whatever beets. we've created now this food system of artificials. Instead of real, there's more and more artificial. And goodness, Sir Albert Howard, who brought, you know, scientific composting to the world in the 1940s after spending his career in India, when he wrote an agricultural testament, which is still kind of considered the foundation of the whole current regenerative agriculture movement. In that book in 1943, he said, when you use artificial fertilizers, that's what he called chemical fertilizers instead of compost, artificial fertilizers, you grow artificial plants, which grow artificial animals, which make artificial people who can only be kept alive with artificials. And he wrote that in 1943.
Oh, God. So we've known this for a long time. We just haven't acted wisely on it. All right. Well, look, I want to get into the solution space real quick as we make the transition there. I do just want to note, and I'll look to anything you want to add to this, Joel, but, COVID definitely did unveil or shone a bright light on some of the weaker points of our current fragile system. Yes, we had some food shortages because of excess demand, but we had supply chains breaking down, sort of everywhere. And in the meatpacking industry, one, you mentioned segregation, where people are kind of, you know, packed in together in these packing plants. You know, COVID sort of decimated the plants. They had to shut a bunch of them down. And we had this reality where we had to cull tens and tens of thousands of pigs because the processing plants have to take them at a certain size. And if the pigs don't get processed and they get bigger, you actually can't process them and you end up having to just cull them. And it's a ton of wasted meat. It's horribly inhumane, horribly wasteful. Just one small example. But when we sort of talk about why care, well, you care for all the health reasons that Joel mentioned, but you also care because there may be a time where, you know, we go through additional breakages in the supply chain. You might not be able to get access to the food that you want. And Joel, you also mentioned that COVID has really sort of disproportionately hurt the small providers, the small restaurants, the small grocery stores, et cetera, and really disproportionately rewarded the big, you know, Whole Foods, Safeways, et cetera, the world. And so it also, from a job standpoint and a local community, a local economy resiliency standpoint, you got to care as well. So Joel, anything you want to add to that is great, but let's transition into this question. What better models out there should we be adopting to have a more resilient and less fragile food system?
Well, if the if the problems are concentration, segregation, regulation, and convenience, it seems like the idea would be to look at the opposite of those. And so the opposite of concentration, of course, is dissemination. Disseminating things widely out on the landscape. So, for example, let's take the COVID thing. It's an excellent example, if instead of having 150 very, very large 4,000 person processing plants in the US, if instead we had 10,000 20 to 50 employee processing plants scattered all over the landscape, what are the chances that those would have had the same kind of breakdowns as the large plants? We actually co-own a small plant with 20 employees. I'm in touch with a lot of people around the country that had those. To my knowledge, nobody, not a single small plant, and I mean a small plant would be, let's say, you know, anybody under 100 employees, no small plant, to my knowledge, had work stoppages or breakdowns or COVID outbreaks in their plants. Not a single one. It was all concentrated in these very, very large places. So we need a decentralized processing capacity and production, again, spread out across the landscape rather than concentrated. And we need integrated systems rather than segregated. So you know, imagine you know, integrating. Let's just take an example. Right now, we're dealing with a lot of fires, and forestry is a big issue. All these fires that we're having, and so just imagine if instead of buying chemical fertilizer, we used dead trees. We chipped up dead trees to do large-scale composting for our fertility program. We essentially creating a carbon economy, so that farms, instead of being segregated from their fertility cycle, were actually using trees and biomass in real-time solar energy in situ to actually drive the organic matter, the fertility of their soils on farm. Not only would we pull the plug on chemical fertilizers and all the dangers that they represent, including a dead zone the size of Rhode Island in the Gulf of Mexico, but we would also, on the other hand, shut down the fire problems we're having. I mean, that's going to be like a $10 billion deal this year, and not to mention the human suffering and the, you know, loss of wineries and everything else. But also this would create an entire thousands and thousands of little, imagine, you know, 6 to 10 person crews out harvesting dead, down, crooked, dying trees to feed into the compost cycle. All right. And so all the money currently spent on fires and chemical fertilizers, instead of being all an expense, it would be invested in upgrading our forest lands to more productivity, more vitality, more health. And suddenly we would have thousands and thousands of really noble, sacred jobs for people who actually want to have calluses and splinters in their hands and work, you know, along with their ecological umbilical. We, as a culture, we have marginalized blue collar workers. We call them blue collar with a bit of a sneer, and marginalized people that get dirty. You know, we even have a whole, you know, thing, Mike Rowe with his dirty jobs program. But, you know, we have marginalized this whole sector, but there are 40% of Americans do not dream about sitting in a Dilbert cubicle at the end of an expressway punching numbers into cyberspace. 40% of people actually don't want to do that. And so how do you affirm those people? How do you build them up in their worth so they can come home from work and little Amy asks, you know, mommy, daddy, what did you do today? And they get to say, oh, well, we upgraded the forest to make wood chips to compost to make earthworms so that you will have healthy water, air, and soil as a legacy for, you know, for you growing up. I mean, that's a noble vocation. And so, you know, integration covers a lot of things, not just ecology, but social and economic and everything else. And then the regulatory thing, you know, we need to have a way for a producer and a consumer to be able to engage in commerce without a bureaucrat involved. Right now, you cannot buy a T-bone steak in my county that was born, raised, and butchered in my county. That T-bone steak has to be exported from the county and then re-imported in order for you to buy a T-bone steak. And this is not about food safety. It's about market access. I can go out in the woods and I can shoot a deer on a 70-degree day, drag it a mile through the squirrel dung and the sticks and the rocks, and parade it around town in the setting sun on the hood of my, you know, my blazer, and then string it up, gut it out, and feed it to my children, and have a neighborhood party and invite everybody to this wonderful feast of venison. And that's all patriotic and a great American. But if I wait for an appropriate day and the same thing to a chicken or a pig or a steer, suddenly I'm a criminal. Now I can give it away, but I can't sell it. So if it's really hazardous, why should I be able to give it away? What is it about selling it that suddenly makes it a hazardous substance? And so what we have right now is an incredible regulatory tyranny on local food, on neighbor-to-neighbor food commerce, that if it were lifted, we would see an explosion of small artisanal craft food opportunities in our neighborhoods. You and I could buy things like charcuterie, bologna, chicken soup. I mean, that we can't even imagine today at a price that we can afford because we could actually do business. My position is if two consenting adults, and I'm using very, powerful language here, if two consenting adults want to exercise voluntary choice for their food, they should be able to engage in consenting choice without a bureaucrat involved.
Hallelujah. Well, Joel, thank you so much. We're going to have to end things here just time-wise, which breaks my heart because I could go for another 3 hours with you easily. But, I do think a simple way for people watching to begin to get involved in supporting the types of movements that Joel mentioned is to support your local farmers. So if you don't have, if you don't live close enough to Polyface Farms, find CSAs in your area that stands for Community Supported Agriculture that give you an opportunity to sort of subscribe to a farm's output and support farmers that are doing their best to create the local resiliency, the unsegregation, the verticality, the healthy nutrition, the deregulation that Joel's been advising. So Joel, can't thank you enough. Best of luck in everything you're doing. And folks that are watching, if you want to learn more about Joel, go visit polyface.farms. And Joel, any other places they should go to learn more about you?
No, the website is full. And shameless plug, we do ship nationwide. If this doorstep delivery is a real deal now. And so sometimes it's just actually, cost competitive and time competitive to just deal with somebody you know. So, we're glad to ship nationwide to at least get you started until you do find your local source.
Excellent. All right, folks. Well, Joel, thanks so much and look forward to talking to you again as soon as we can.
Thank you, Adam. My delight.